Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in a public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the rackets when we come back. You know, in Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. It says, "By what way is it that the light is parted?" Or if it's paraphrased, it says, "Well, by what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated?" Now, can you imagine asking a question like that 4,000 years ago? Today, of course, it's a simple question, and the student answers, well, by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known about a spectroscope 4,000 years ago back in Job's day? Now, when we heat a metal red hot, then the heat any substance until it's incandescent. It gives forth rays of light. Now, these rays of light, when you pass them through the prism of the spectroscope, they divide themselves on a graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, we need only to pass the light ray through the spectroscope to see the composition of that star and the proportion of each of its ingredients. This division of light rays is constant. It doesn't vary, so we can always rely upon the results. Well, spectroscopic analysis is an exact science, and this is the manner by which the light is apportioned. And you know, this places us in a quandary, because either Job knew that, or we're dealing with supernatural wisdom that's being revealed here. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And it's one more of our many lessons in the Mosaic Law School here at Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it? All right, we're talking about the rackets, and one of the things that I pointed out to you last time was that these rackets, the 20 that I've thought up and told you about, 20 rackets, like religion, for instance, is a racket. Charity is a racket. Have you seen all these charities? You know, they come on. The Red Cross is a charity, and they're a good example of a racketeering operation. They're criminal. They're dishonest. They steal money. And that's the Red Cross. And they're if they're not the number one, they certainly got to be in the top five charitable institutions here in the United States. And indeed, the Red Cross is worldwide. And I'm not suggesting to you that they don't do some good works. You know, there's always good works out there that somebody does, and they ought to be commended for it. And the Red Cross does do some good works. But they charge a lot of money for their good works, and they lie a lot about their good works. And there's a statement here in the Bible that deals with this thing of good works, especially as it relates to preachers. It's over in Matthew 7, verse 21. It says, "Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Now many will say unto me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, and in your name have cast out devils, and in your name have done many wonderful works?" Hear those wonderful works. And Jesus went on to say in verse 23, "Then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity." Now, looking back to 9/11, the Red Cross put out a call. And here we're looking at these buildings down and thousands of people dead. And they didn't even know at that time how many people were killed. It could have been, had it been a little later in the day, up to 50,000 people, you know, are in those buildings at any given time. I mean, imagine where you'd be with a death toll if you had 50,000 people in those buildings, you know, say at, 10, 11, 12 o'clock, or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Anyway, here's the two buildings, and they're knocked down, and New York is devastated, and everybody is shocked beyond description here. And so the Red Cross sent out a message nationwide. Give to your local Red Cross chapter so that we can help the victims of 9/11. Of course, you know, you're looking right at this disaster, thousands of people dead. And so you say to yourself, well, yeah, I want to give money to the Red Cross. And so a lot of charities came on the scene and said, well, send money for the 9/11 victims. And maybe you sent money. No, I never sent a dime. Not a dime. That's how jaded I am about charities. And the reason is that I have seen this over and over and over again. The theft that goes on in the name of charity. Stealing my money. Now, I'm not opposed to giving money. I'm not opposed to giving and helping somebody that's down and needs help, like they are down in Galveston and Houston and in New Orleans. But when I give the money, I want it to go to something that makes sense. I want my money, I want my resources, my labor, to actually help somebody. I really don't want to build a wing onto a $10 million mansion in Tampa, Florida, for the executive director of the charity that I'm giving this money to. That's the thing that bothers me. And these people, they say, well, look at all of our good works. Look at all the people that we're helping. And, you know, they're not lying to you. Not a one of them's lying to you. They actually take your money, and they actually help somebody with it. My complaint is that you send them $100, and 90 of it goes to building that wing on the $10 million mansion of the executive director in Tampa, Florida, and $10 goes to the starving child in Peru. I don't know how much it costs to raise money. We do a charitable program here. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. But I'm not asking you people for any money. Not once have I ever come on the air and said, hey, send me your money and we'll go out and do some wonderful works and we'll spread the word to everybody. And just be a real blessing to your heart, you know. Hell, I don't need your help. And I'm not building a $10 million mansion down Tampa, Florida. And if I was, I'd have built it on my own time and with my own money. Not, you know, come to you and say, here, won't you help? Won't you do this or that or something else? Because when somebody asks you for your help, we presume that that person is incapable, unable to carry this out without your help. And so they're appealing to you. They're appealing to your vanity is what they're doing. Well, yes, I think I could help these people. We're all motivated by vanity. And so, yeah, I want to help that little girl down there in Peru, and I want to help those 9/11 victims out there. And then we found out that the Red Cross was not spending that money that they told us. See, the reason that they wanted us to give the money was to help 9/11 victims. But they took the money and they used it for other purposes. Now, you might want to give money to the Red Cross, and I'm sure that the Red Cross was spending the money on other purposes. And maybe those other purposes were very, very worthwhile. But I resent being lied to by the Red Cross or anybody else about motivating me to give money and then taking the money and using it for some other purpose. You know, if you come to me and say, we want to use this money for victims of 9/11. Okay, well, then that's where that money ought to go, period. It shouldn't go for flood relief in California or Azerbaijan or any place else. It goes just to that because that's what you're asking for. But these charities, they lie to you constantly, and it's a fraud. And furthermore, these charities are all they're all licensed by the government. The government's right in this fraud, right up to their eyeballs, right along with the board of directors and the CEO of the charity itself. And Congress actually had some hearings on the Red Cross practice, and they censured them, but they didn't put anybody in jail. They didn't stop the practice. They said that's naughty and that's a no-no and you ought not to do that and blah, blah, blah. And so there were some hearings. You know, the government, when they get caught like that, they call for hearings, and then they have these hearings, and then you don't hear another word about it. Nothing's ever done. Nothing ever changes. You've been listening to your government talk about campaign contributions and undue influence over legislators for, hell, as long as you can live, as long as you've been alive. And nothing's ever been done. The problem gets bigger and bigger and worser, doesn't it? So I'm not expecting the Red Cross or any of these charities to reform, but there is something that I can do about it. I don't give them a dime. Not a dime. Now, I've got a can over here. It's called Third Tithe. And in the Bible, there's a modality that's used for charity. In fact, Third Tithe, once or twice every seven-year cycle, there's a tithe. 10% of what you make, you put it into a can to help the poor, the widows, the orphans, those that are in need. Now, every once in a while, we have a tornado comes through our region of the country over here, and it knocks somebody's house down or something. And there's plenty of charity right here in my own backyard. See, I live in the poorest county in Missouri, Ozark County, Missouri. They tell me it's the poorest county. Has the lowest income level and the highest welfare rates and levels and so on. So there's no shortage of poor people here in this county. There's no shortage of need here. And so I can take my third tithe can, and when the occasion arises and there's somebody that's in need, then I can take some money, put it in the form of a gold coin, put it in the mail, and one day this guy wakes up and he gets a gold coin in the mail. Totally anonymous. You never, in the Bible, it tells you not to let the right hand know what the left hand is doing. And the government comes in and says, if you'll give this money, we'll give you a tax deduction. That's so that everybody will know what a righteous giver you are. You give you a 501c3 tax deduction. The God in the Bible told you, don't you let anybody know when you give them money, when you give them help with charity. Don't let anybody know that you're the guy that's behind it. And God says, I will bless you secretly. You give secretly, I'll bless you secretly. If you want recognition under 501c3, then that is your reward. And that's all you're going to get from me. So I just thought I'd pass that one on to you. And these charities over here are a racket, and they're all licensed by the government. See, the mafia isn't in charities. See, they're not licensing people to go out here and make appeals to you. There's one that really galls me. They come over the TV every once in a while, and they've got this pathetic little child with tears streaming down her face. And she's dressed in rags, and she's dirty. And then there's a caption that says, I think it's a Save the Children or something like that. Save this child or something. And you know, your heart just bleeds for this little child. And you say to yourself, God, I want to help that little child. And then they tell you, it only costs 40 cents a day to feed this child. If you'll send us just 40 cents a day. Well, how much is that? Let's see, there's 365 days in a year times 0.40. $146 a year. I could feed one starving child in Peru or Ecuador or someplace for $150 a year. Would you give $150 to feed one starving child? Hell yeah, I'd be happy to give $150 to feed a starving child. So then we got to looking. This is one of those charities, you know, that was uncovered, you know. And the executive director of this company lives in Tampa, Florida. And he lives in a $10 million house, but it was a $3 million house. And 90% of the money that you give to this charity, see, they were investigated by Congress or somebody, and they're actually taking money, and they're licensed, bonded, and insured. The government authorizes their charter and their existence. They've got offices, and they've got staff and personnel. and they actually take your money and buy food and they ship it off to Ecuador, 10 cents out of every dollar that you give goes to actually feeding that child. So in order for me to feed that child, I would have to give times 10. I'd have to give $1,460 to the charity in order to get $146 into the stomach of that starving child. Now, it may well be that that's cheap. That may be the right proportion. I don't know. I haven't got a clue. I don't know how much money it takes to raise money, to put on those ads on television, to get the photographs taken and the posters made up. But from my own personal experience, I think that 10% is nowhere near enough, and 90%, which goes for the operation of the charity and so on, is way too much. Now, that's just my personal opinion. If you can't do better than that, I ain't going to donate to you. When I found out about it, I stopped. Now you might say, well, okay, just because there's one or two bad ones out there doesn't mean we shouldn't give to charity. Well, last week I think I told you a story about cancer. You know, cancer is a devastating disease, and it kills 500,000 people a year. And the Cancer Society, they're constantly after you to donate money for cancer. I pointed out there's already 14 cures to cancer. 14. And about 8 or 10 of them were discovered by the American Medical Association, or people that were medical doctors, not quacks out here, you know, telling you to, you know, turn around three times and shake bat's knuckles under the full moon, drink goat's blood or something. It's not by those crazy kooks out there. I mean, these are scientists, doctors, been working on the problem. And they take their own doctors and scientists and lock them up and put them in prison when they find a cancer cure. Every time, every one of these guys that have come up with a cancer cure has been jailed or prosecuted for it. Every one of them, no exceptions. So I take a look at that and I say, well, it's pretty obvious to me that the powers that be, that is the United States government and the Food and Drug Administration, they do not want a cure for cancer. So there's no need for me to give money to the American Cancer Society. I don't know what the hell they're doing with the money, but they're not finding a cure to cancer. And your tax dollars are being used, whether you like it or not, for cancer research. I don't like it, but then, you know, it's the way life is. They can just take your money and spend it on AIG, or take your money and spend it on buying some new multinational corporation so that the government can become the biggest insurer in the world, or the biggest stock brokerage house in the world, or the biggest investment bank in the world, or whatever, you know. That's called fascism. I'm not interested in spending my money voluntarily or involuntarily on these kinds of programs, but that's the way it is. So I take a look at these charities and I say, well, let me report to you that these charities, without exception, every single one of them, are licensed, bonded, and insured by the United States government. And every single one of them, without exception, including the biggest and the best and the brightest, the Red Cross, are a pack of thieves. And they've been identified as thieves and liars. And that they're stealing your money. That's a fraud. It's an illegal activity, is what it is. It's illegal. It isn't honest. They do it by fraud, or they do it by threat or harm. Now, the Red Cross isn't threatening me, and they're not harming me, but they're lying to me. And what they're doing is dishonest. In fact, it isn't even legal. And that's why they got censured and reprimanded. They did that with blood some years back. You know, they were supposed to clean up the blood supply. They didn't. And they went out and killed a bunch more people, you know, with their tainted blood with HIV, you know. Remember that scandal? Well, did anybody go to jail? Did anything get changed? Did some new law get put on the books? Did somebody do something constructive to stop it? Now, coupled right there with the charities is religion. And religion, a lot of the time, is behind these charities. The religious groups, you know, they're charitable. They're asking you for your money constantly. And they actually use threats of harm to extort money from their parishioners. I remember old Frank Rocha back in 1955 when I was just a kid. You know, he was telling me a story. He said the priest came out. He's a Catholic, you know, Rocha, an Italian guy. No, he was a Portuguese guy, Rocha was. Anyway, he told me about the priest came out from Eureka and sat down with him and talked to him and handed him a bill for $5,000. And what was the bill? Well, it was his contribution. It was what the priest determined he should give to the church, $5,000. And Frank complained about it. He said, well, $5,000 seems like an awful lot of money. And it isn't that Frank didn't have the $5,000 because he gave it. But he didn't give the money because he wanted to or because he thought of it or because he said, I think the Catholic Church needs $5,000 and I want to write him a check and send him the money. It was because the priest came out and said, that's what you owe. That's what your share is. You can afford to pay it. And if you don't, you're going to go to hell and burn forever. Now, that's a threat of harm. And religions do that constantly. It's very common. It isn't just the Catholics. Everybody else doing the same thing. If you don't do what we tell you to do, you're going to go to hell and burn forever. You're not going to go to heaven and be with Jesus or Buddha or Allah or whatever. You know, I'm sure that the same problem is out there in the rest of the world as it is here in the United States. But there's something I can do about it. I don't have to give those guys a dime. I don't have to participate in their thefts. And I don't. And I thought I'd share that with you and tell you. Let me tell you a little story here about the Seventh-day Adventists. You know, they're probably as good as any and better than most. But they're liars and thieves. Yeah, the Seventh-day Adventists, well, at least the ones in Tulsa, Oklahoma, are. They're liars and thieves. And I presume that they're probably about the same in the rest of the country. And I'm not just zeroing in on you Advents over there. Hell, just any church, I don't care what it is, just label them and name them, and all of them, you know, just about all of them. In fact, one lawyer said that he did not know of any churches in America that were not 501c3 tax-exempt institutions. I got news for him. There's 6,000 that aren't. So there's 6,000 out there that you might want to give some money to. But if I heard that this church is tax exempt, I wouldn't give them a dime. Not a penny. I probably wouldn't give them a dime even if they weren't tax exempt. But I'll guarantee if they are tax exempt, they're thieves. And they're in bed with the government is what it boils down to. And this Seventh-day Advent guy came over here to school one day, and there's a lesson in our tax school that deals with obligations that parishioners have to their church, legal obligations that they have to their church. If you're a member of a church, you have, by law, legal obligations. You probably didn't know that, but I'm telling you, you do. Well, how do I know that? Well, because it's written right into your church charter. Well, how do I know that? Because I read the church charter. No, I didn't read your particular church charter, but I've seen enough of them I've read enough fine print, you know, on these contracts and these memberships and one thing and another. I know how this game's played, so let me just share it with you so you can figure this out for yourself, you know. Anyway, if you are a member of a church, unless or until you give them written notice that you're withdrawing your membership and that you want to withdraw your power of attorney that the church has by virtue of your membership over there, you're a member of the church. And you don't have to be attending church. The last time you went to church was 30 years ago. And you can still be obligated to pay their debts in the event that they go upside down. So I told this Advent guy that was just routine. I wasn't picking on Advents one way or the other, or Catholics or Protestants or anybody else, just pointing out that there's a legal obligation over here and you should be aware of it and understand how that works and what your potential liability could be as a member of an organization. And this process is called adhesion contracts. You know, there's contracts and then there's contracts of adhesion. And if you look it up, you know, the average guy, if you said this is an adhesion contract, adhesion, he could probably understand that's a Band-Aid being applied to your skin. But, you know, if you said a contract of adhesion, he'd probably look at you and stare, you know, and wonder what the hell you're talking about. But anyway, the contracts of adhesion lessons here. And so I pointed out to him that as a member of a church, just as an illustration, you could be a surety underwriter of the church's debt. And he was just incredulous. He just couldn't believe it. And I said, why don't you go check your church charter and find out? So he called me up sometime later. And he said, I'm having some problems over here. Remember in class you talked about adhesion contracts and about your potential surety underwriter liability. And so I thought I'd take you up on the challenge. I think you're wrong. I don't believe you. I didn't believe you. And I wanted to prove that you were either right or wrong. And so I went to the deacon of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 501c3, chartered by the state of Oklahoma. Local church group. And I went to the deacon and I said, like a copy of the church charter. And he said, what do you want it for? And he said, I want to see what my legal liabilities are. And the deacon said, well, number one, you don't have any legal liabilities. And number two, you can't have the church charter because it's none of your business. You're a layperson. You're not a deacon. You're not on the board of directors. You're not a member of the inner circle here of the leadership of the church. And you can't have the church charter. Now, I pointed out to this guy when he was in class that a church charter, it's a corporate charter is what it is. Boys and girls, that's a public record. The charter of General Motors is a public record. You can get it from your Secretary of State. You got to pay for it. I mean, you can't just walk in there and say, give me the charter of General Motors, but if you walk in and you say, I want General Motors charter, Ford Motor Company charter, or the charter of Microsoft, you go to the Secretary of State of that state where that charter is recorded. And in Oklahoma, you pay them $5, at least it used to be, $5, and they give you a copy of the charter. Sometimes they're 10, 15, 20 pages. And I pointed that out to him. I said, well, if they won't give you the charter, you'll have to go to the Secretary of State in Oklahoma City. Put your money on the counter, and they'll just go over and photocopy their charter and give it to you. So he did. Now, from Tulsa to Oklahoma City, it's 127 miles. So he got in his car, drove 127 miles one way, walked into the Capitol building, walked up to the Secretary of State and said, give me a copy of the church charter of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Okay. They gave it to him. He called me back again. He says, I can't believe what I just read here. And he read to me paragraph 18. And paragraph 18 said, without any equivocation, it says that the members of the church are surety underwriters of the church's debt. Now, it just so happens that the church at that time had 200 members in their church, round numbers, 200, and had a $200,000 debt. You know, on the pews and songbooks and church building. And a lot of times these churches will have you sign a card. It's called the Building Fund Pledge. I did that one time. I pledged $5 a month when I was about 12 years old. $5 a month, $60 a year, to the Building Fund of the Lutheran Church, Trinity Lutheran Church, in Eureka, California. I just a little kid, 12 years old, delivering newspapers for crying out loud. Now, $60 a year was equal to 1 month's delivery of newspapers. So I was being pretty generous. I thought, you know, giving 1 month of my wages a year to the church. And, of course, that's a charity. And so I signed a little card, and they put that in there. So I don't know where they put it, but, you know, they had a little card there. And it said Building Fund right on the face of it. And they wanted my name, address, and phone number, and how much I'm pledging, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they could build a new church building, and they did. Now, unbeknownst to the average Joe Sixpack who signs that building pledge, you know, you thought that it was for internal use, so that they'd have a basis there for it. And they tell you that you don't have to, you know, if there's some reason that you can't pay, it's not binding upon you. You know, if you can't make your payment every month, $5, well, that's fine. But when they would give you an envelope, they would want you to put on their building fund, you know. So when Sunday came, you know, and you put your money in the offering plate, they wanted the envelope plainly marked building fund so they'd know where to put it. Now, that's deceptive. It's deceptive because they're going to make the payment to the bank whether enough people gave their money in the building fund. Do you think that at the end of the month when it comes time to write in the check to the bank to pay the mortgage on the church and they're short $100, do you think that they're going to send a $100 payment short, you know, or do you think they're not going to make their payment? No, they're going to take it right out of the offering plate or wherever else they get money or have money to make up that shortfall. They're not going to miss that payment. Now, here's another little kicker. The church now, who's supposed to be teaching you biblical principles, is paying interest on this loan to the bank where they borrowed the money. And when they borrowed the money, they didn't borrow just weights and balances. They borrowed Federal Reserve notes. Worse yet, they didn't even borrow Federal Reserve notes. They borrowed computer entry chips, or they borrowed on a deposit slip. Nobody down at the bank ever went back in the vault, you know, and pulled out a bunch of $100 bills and gave the church $50,000. They didn't do that. They just gave you a deposit in your account, so you go out and spend the money. Just created that money right out of thin air. And so here's this guy. He comes back now and he calls me. He tells me, "Hey, look, you were right, Mr. Gordon." And he said, "It just happens that that's about $1,000 for each person here that is a member of the church." And I said, "Yeah, it just about works out this way. And here, and did you notice you've got joint and several liability? Joint and several liability." And what that means, it's a legal term, what that means is that, let's suppose 200 members of the church all sign a pledge to the building fund, and they don't meet that pledge, and the church can't pay the bank back. Does the bank come out and foreclose on the church? Well, they could. That's a remedy that they have available to them. They can just come out and take the church. But that's bad public relations, and banks don't do that. They're not going to go out here and foreclose on your church. That's like foreclosing on a widow. That's foreclosing on an orphan. I mean, that's just bad public relations, and then nobody likes to hear that. They only do that in the last resort. What they do is they go to the members of the church that signed the pledge on the building fund, and that's what all those pledges are all about. They're looking for deep pockets contributors, deep pocket defendants. And so let's suppose you're a doctor, a lawyer, an Indian chief, and you belong to this church. Then the pastor or the board of directors, they go into the bank, they want to borrow money, and they say, "Look, we got Dr. So-and-so as a member of our church." And the banker, he looks at that and says, "That's wonderful, that's good, that's great." They don't want Bessie Balmortal, you know, some old widow over here. They want Dr. Smedley. Well, that's the guy we want over here, and that's the guy they've got. And so they've got this doctor over here. Now, if for some reason they have to foreclose, they can just go to the doctor's bank account and take the whole $200,000 right out of his bank account. Never say a word to him. They don't need a word. They don't need a writ of execution. They don't need a trial. They don't need testimony and witnesses. They just go take the money. He's already signed the agreement. It's called the building fund. Now, the building fund is tied directly to membership in the church, and membership in the church is regulated by state statutes. So the government's right in on this. They don't come out here and tell you parishioners in these churches over here that you're a surety underwriter for the church's debt with joint and several liability. And it's the state, it's your government that is in bed with that church. That's why they give them 501c3 tax exemption. It's the government involved in this kind of fraud with the Red Cross and with that Seventh-day Adventist church to defraud you, to lie to you. And you might be sitting there saying, "Well, I don't care. It doesn't make any difference to me. I want to give my heart to Jesus." Okay. I didn't come here to tell you not to. No skin off my back one way or the other. I'm just here as a reporter to tell you, did you know that that's going on? Did you know that that's what they're doing to you? You know, if you don't care, that's fine. If you do care, do something about it. Hey, let me give you a reminder here at the halfway point in the program that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through the website. Remember, that website is georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now be sure to order yours. Just call us and ask for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. That's the place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. And you can see whether or not we're the right-wing, reactionary, radical kooks that you think we are. And you can get all the facts right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, they're accurate, and they're correct, at least to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, that doesn't mean that the authors or publications that we're recommending and endorsing are going to reciprocate by recommending and endorsing us. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, they're mine and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent now the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the rackets. And the thing that I picked out of this is that the mafia, you know, those Cosa Nostra, those Godfather dons, you know, that we hear about so often, and these war against the rackets, you know, the government is at war. Bobby Kennedy, I remember, he was at war with the mafia. Why? Well, because the mafia is competition. And everybody who does business with the mafia is one less customer to do business with the United States government. Let's take a look at drugs as an illustration here. We have a thing here called the war on drugs. The war on drugs is a racket. See, the government is in bed with the pharmaceutical industry. They fund them with taxpayer dollars. They collect taxes from Merck and Pfizer and all these drug companies and manufacturers out there. They're collecting taxes off of those corporations, which are collecting the money from you through your prescriptions. And the government is in bed with drug dealers. Medical doctors are drug dealers, and they're selling Vioxx. And they're selling all these drugs that you see advertised on the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric. So the government is not opposed to drugs at all. They're opposed to certain drugs. Well, that's not even true. Well, let's think about that for a minute. Is the United States government opposed to heroin? They tell you that they are. But, you see, heroin is the street name for morphine. And the United States government licenses Merck and all these pharmaceutical companies to manufacture morphine to give to your medical doctor so he can sell it to you. They're not opposed to morphine. And that morphine comes from Afghanistan. You know, among other places, but Afghanistan, where they grow those poppies over there. And so, you know, they're out there manufacturing and selling drugs. Now, if somebody else is manufacturing drugs and selling them down on the street corner, and get this, if you go to your medical doctor And you say to him, well, I'd like some cocaine. He would correct you and say, well, we don't sell cocaine, but here's the name that we use for this drug. And it's an over the, you know, it won't be over the counter, it'll be a prescription drug. And then he sells it. Do you know how much that prescription drug costs? 6 times more than you can buy cocaine down on the street corner from Joe, the drug dealer. That's why there's so many illegal drugs in the country. Now, I have never talked. My brother was a drug dealer, if he's still alive. I've talked to him for years and years now, but he was in the drug business, illegal drugs. He's selling cocaine and marijuana and heroin out in California. He was a unlicensed drug dealer. He never once ever complained to me that he was not getting paid enough money for the drugs that he was selling on the street corner. I never heard my brother ever complain a single time that he was in rags or he was poverty stricken because of the low prices that he was getting for his cocaine. And he was selling it for 1/6 what the medical doctor sells it for down on the street corner. What the United States government has done, they've come up with a war on drugs to put these illegal drug dealers out of business. They don't want the competition. That's all that boils down to. It's just a racket. Nothing more, nothing less. And get this, it's prohibited in the Bible. You know, this thing of taking drugs is attached to witchcraft. Witchcraft is a capital felony. It's called the art of the apothecary in the Bible. Do you know that? Did you know that drug dealing, well, I don't care whether you're going down here and getting the prescription from Dr. Marcus Welby. It's a capital felony. Whether you're buying it from my brother on the street corner or you're buying it from Marcus Welby, MD, with a Rexall prescription, it's a capital felony. It's against the law to do that. I saw this number the other day. It was kind of shocking. Did you know that if you're 65 years old or older, on average, in America, you take 6 prescription drugs. Did you know that? I'm 65. I don't take any prescription drugs. Hell, I don't even take aspirin. I avoid that stuff like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Why? Bad for your health. Aspirin has a side effect. Causes stomach bleeding. Listen to what these guys are telling you when they advertise on Katie Couric. And they tell you, no, this could cause this and that, and another thing may cause, like Viagra, for instance. Did you know that Viagra can cause blindness? Yeah, people take Viagra and they go blind. Hell, all the guy wanted was a little treat on Friday night, you know, maybe with his wife or his girlfriend or Sadie down at Flo's Whorehouse. I don't know where he needed this Viagra, but he goes in here. Did you know that sexual activity should be normal when you're 99 years old? Did you know that Abraham sired a child when he was 99? Did you know that? I thought I'd point that out to you. In the Bible, there are several cases here where old men pushing 100 years old, you know, are still having children. So I'll throw that out there for your consideration. So I'm an old man. I don't need any Viagra. You know? Thought I'd throw that one out there for you, too. But now, you're convinced that you need this Viagra, and they're selling millions and maybe even billions of dollars worth of prescriptions for this Viagra, selling sex. And the government's right in there taking their cut. And I'll bet you, I don't know how much this Viagra costs, but if the cost gets to be, you know, too high, then they'll have it out on the street. And somebody will undercut. They'll sell it to you for cheaper. I'll bet you if you asked your local drug supplier, you know, the guy that you buy your cocaine from or your marijuana, ask him what he can get Viagra for, and I'll bet you that he can get it for about 80% less than you're paying for it right now. Yeah. Can you believe that? So don't kid yourself. And he's not complaining about the prices that he's getting for it either. Hell, he'll sell it to you at a bargain basement price. And that's why you have a war on drugs. It doesn't have anything to do with drug addiction. It doesn't have anything to do with the people that are hooked on heroin or anything else like that. It has to do with competition. It's nothing more than a racket. And the government's into it right up to their eyeballs. And they're running around here telling you, you need to join DARE. You know, we're opposed to these illegal drugs that they're selling to our kids. Hell, you people out there are not opposed to drugs. And you're teaching drug and drug culture to your children. Take a look. You've got in your house a medicine cabinet with drugs in it. Hell, your children are raised with a mentality of drugs. Hell, you're probably a drug addict. You know, if you're an average American, you are. I think 80% of Americans are on drugs. And if you're 65, you're on six. Only 20% of Americans are drug-free. That's why we have a drug culture over here. If the rest of you people in the world are wondering why it is that you Americans over there have this drug culture, hell, we're taught and trained to use drugs from the first grade. Hell, even before the first grade. Our parents are drug addicts. Our grandparents are drug addicts. Drugs are a part and parcel of American culture. So for us to have a war on drugs is like a dog, you know, having a war on bones. I mean, it's just preposterous. It's nonsense. We all ought to just admit, hey, we're all a bunch of drug addicts. The whole American nation is addicted to drugs. And then let's just come out and tell the truth. The reason we're against heroin and cocaine and marijuana is because it cuts into our sales at Rexall and Osco Buttery. Cuts into our tax revenue. We don't want that. We don't want competition. So the mafia is out here competing then. You know, they're bringing in this illegal heroin, and they're fulfilling, they're satisfying a niche market. There's a lot of people out there that want to buy heroin. And they cannot afford to have or to pay six times more. I mean, you normal people out there, you know, you're working at Boeing Aircraft, and hell, you can just go down and get a prescription from your doctor and then go down to the Rexall drugstore and get your heroin. But, you know, a lot of people out there, they can't afford that. And so they're out here looking for a bargain, and they find it down here with Joe the drug dealer. And then the government comes along and says, well, we need a war on drugs. And then they get out here and they advertise this constantly over the TV. And then they come up with a guy, they call him the drug czar. And he reports to Congress. Hell, the Congress isn't ignorant about this. The president knows about how this works. Let me show you how the government's involved in drugs. See, over in Afghanistan, I don't know if you knew this or not, but I'll tell you if you didn't. Afghanistan has traditionally been, since the time of the British, 200 years ago, it has been the primary source of those opium poppies. The primary source of opium poppies. And it was the British drug trade. The British had that drug trade locked up for a couple hundred years. Well, after the Russians were thrown out of Afghanistan, an outfit took over there. They called them the Taliban. Now, I'm not really up on Muslim religion, but, you know, these guys are Muslims, and they're kind of religious, and they're opposed to drugs. These Muslims, you know, they're fundamentalist religious kooks, and they're opposed to heroin. So they just closed everybody down, killed them. They were probably ruthless. They weren't kind, and they weren't gentle, and they killed all these drug growers in Afghanistan. They stamped out the world's supply of heroin. All right, now, here comes 9/11, for whatever reason. 9/11 comes up, and America says, hell, we got to go get this Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, so let's go get him. And they did. They went over there, and they conquered Afghanistan. The United States Army went over there, just threw them out. All right, now, where is drug production? Where is opium poppy production now? Okay, in 2005... or 2006, I guess it was 2006, opium production in Afghanistan equaled its pre-Taliban levels. You know, before the Taliban came in and stamped out the drug trade in Afghanistan, after the Russians gave up and left, the heroin coming out of Afghanistan dropped to zero. Or very close to it. And then in 2005, just a couple of 3 years after we got over there and occupied the country, it was up to its pre-Taliban levels. Then in 2007, they had a bumper crop. It was the biggest crop in the history of Afghanistan. Now I heard the other day, the 2008 crop is going to top the 2007 crop. Now, do you believe, boys and girls, that a bunch of sand jockeys wearing turbans on their head, for crying out loud, running around in the desert out there without helicopters and without all the sophisticated electronics technician technical equipment that we have to detect, you know, like our virtual fence at the border to keep illegal immigrants out of the country, you know, all this technology, that these sand jockeys are, they can stamp out the heroin poppy trade, but the United States of America can't? Huh? You're going to stand there and tell me you actually believe that? You know, anybody that believes that kind of crap is in line for buying a bridge in Brooklyn. You know that? I mean, you got to be so totally divorced from reality that you belong in a mental hospital. I mean, you need help. And that's the official line that comes out of our government. Oh, we're just out here working as hard as we can to stamp out the drug trade, but, you know, got all these terrorists running around over here, and we just haven't got the time, and we just don't know what we're going to do. Hell, it's probably being flown out of there on U.S. government airplanes. I don't know that positively, but I'll guarantee you this, it's a racket. Nothing more, nothing less. And I've read reports where, hell, they're hauling drugs out of South America. The CIA, this is the United States Secret Spook Service, the CIA, on marine jet aircraft and hauling them into San Diego, or they call that Camp Pendleton. I've read reports about that. I don't know how true they are. I don't know how openly and notoriously the CIA is involved in the drug trade. I think they probably send that down the line and let private entrepreneurs do that. But you can just be rest assured, you know, it's guaranteed that some big fat cats up here high in government offices overlooking the Potomac River are involved in that drug trade over there in Afghanistan. They're getting paid off. And that's what makes it a racket. It's illegal. God in the Bible prohibits that kind of activity. And this lying, you know, the Seventh-day Adventist Church lying to their parishioners, the deacon telling this guy, oh, you don't have any liability. Now, hell, that deacon, he's probably legally ignorant and incompetent and probably doesn't know. He may actually believe, oh, that's just your building fund. That's just, it's just your membership. That doesn't have anything to do with the church debt. Well, it doesn't make any difference if you're lying to these people and you know about it, which is called an actual fraud, or you're lying to them and you actually believe the lie yourself, which is called a constructive fraud. It's still a fraud. A fraud is a lie. Nothing more, nothing less, deacon. Anyway, this guy, after the deacon told him, no, he couldn't have the church charter, he went to the preacher. He said, Mr. Preacher, I'd like to have a copy of the church charter. And the preacher was taken aback. He said, well, why do you want it? He said, I want to see what my legal liabilities are. And the preacher assured him that there weren't any legal liabilities for the lay people in the church, and no, he couldn't have the church charter. Why would the preacher and the deacon tell a member of the church that they didn't want you to have your church charter? Why don't you go try that next Sunday? You know, when you're walking out and you're shaking hands with the preacher, why don't you say, hey, preacher, can I have a copy of the church charter? Could you send that over? Here's my address. Here's my business card. Would you fax me over a copy of the church charter so I can see what my legal liabilities are? See what happens. Because this guy said he was threatened with excommunication if he continued on with his persistence. Is this church charter now top secret? Is this something that comes from the CIA? Hell no, it's a public document. I can go get the church charter of the Seventh-day Adventist Church of Tulsa, Oklahoma, for crying out loud. And so can you or anybody else. Public information. Well, then why in the hell can't the people that are the members of the church get a copy from the leadership of the church? Huh? What the hell is that all about? Are they ashamed of it? Does it contain pornography? Do they have pictures of naked ladies in their church charter, and that's why they're just real reticent about giving it to their church members? Hey, you know, I get real suspicious about people, you know, when they write with fine print. And that's because when I read the fine print, I had a guy the other day sent me a mortgage contract. His son had bought a house, and his wife had bought a house up in Wisconsin. He sent me the mortgage contract. I hadn't read one of these for years and years. The whole thing is in fine print. So I got my contract reading glasses out. See, I'm a coin collector, and I got a pair of glasses that go right down over my eyeballs. You know, it fits right on my head as a band. It goes on my head. And I just flip it down, and it's a 10-power loop is what it is. And so I can read the dates on my coins and mint marks and look at the scuff marks, you know, on them. And that's what I have in order to read these contracts. And boys and girls, I don't wear glasses. I don't need glasses to read. I think my vision's about 20/20. I haven't been to an optometrist for a long time. The reason I don't go to an optometrist is because I don't need glasses and I don't wear glasses. And so what in the hell would I go to one for? What would be the purpose? So... But listen, boys and girls, I'm an old man. I got to tell you, I don't deny it. But I don't wear glasses, and I can't read those contracts. I got to have glasses to read them. Now, why do you think that they're writing those contracts in fine print? It's because they don't want you to read it. Why did you think your church doesn't want to give you the church charter? Because they haven't got a copy in the office? No, it's because they don't want you to read it. Well, I read this guy's mortgage contract. I couldn't believe what I was reading. I know that those people never read that mortgage before they signed it. Nobody with an IQ above 80 would sign a mortgage contract if they read it. And I don't mean you have to understand it. Hell, if you've got a fourth grade education, son, fourth grade, if you'd sign a mortgage contract issued by a bank in the United States of America, you're mentally defective. If you would sign a credit card application after you read the terms and conditions, which you can't read without a 10-power loop, I'll just tell you right now, if you've just got 20/20 vision, you can't read those fine prints in those contracts. I don't know what kind of vision you'd have to read it. I'm not sure I could have read that thing when I was 12 years old. I'm not sure my eyes were that good when I was 12. I don't think my eyes are as good as they were when they were 12, but they ain't a hell of a lot worse. And I got to have glasses to read it. I got to magnify it. And then after I read it, I said, oh my God, this guy want to know, well, what am I going to do? You got to put your head between your knees and kiss her goodbye is what you're going to do. They had a clause in that contract, just to show you how this fraud works. And remember that the United States government licenses these banks. They're in bed with the banks. I'll tell you about the banking racket next time. But the contract over here says, if you've got money in the bank and you don't make your mortgage payment, we'll seize your bank accounts. Isn't that special? If you have a car loan with our bank, and you fail to make your mortgage payment, we will foreclose on your house because you missed your car payment. There's a clause in there that provides for that. Did you know that? You mean to tell me you'd put money in that bank? You mean to tell me you'd take a car loan out from that bank? You mean to tell me that you'd have a mortgage with that bank? And you knew? Oh, my God. I couldn't believe it, but there it is. He signed it. There's his signature, him and his wife both. Best thing can happen to him is give the damn house back to the bank and get out of that boar's nest. And I'm about out of time here, boys and girls. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries. Daily over the internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, all of these law or programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course, talking about the rackets. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.